An unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning.
Welcome.
Morning, thank you.
I'm going to talk about practice period again, in a different perspective, and I'm going to be reading somewhat from an essay by the Japanese founder of our school, a man named Dogen, who was born in 1200 and had a city there. And he uses a word, which is a Japanese word for practice period, which is ango. And he's referring to a monastic retreat that lasts 90 days. And it sounds like they only did it in the summer. I don't know. He makes some reference to, I heard that they could do it, that they did it in the winter some places, but I'm not sure if they do it the same as the summer. I thought they did it pretty much year round, but they do now. I don't know. At any rate, that period of retreat. And we are about to start our version, which is, I think that it's 7 weeks long now, or almost 7 weeks long, rather than 12. And this is not a monastic place. This is a lay practice place, pretty much. So we have to translate it a little bit, maybe a lot. But I think the point remains the same. He's talking about completely entering into it. And he actually makes a couple of jokes, which is this one of the things about this man, is that he never jokes. There are other old ancient Zen masters who were funny. Dogen is not among them. So you can feel it. This was a talk that he gave, I think it was at the end of the summer ango, the summer practice period. So maybe he was feeling kind of lighter. I don't know. Ours starts October 1st, and I just think it's useful to kind of set our intention so as to be able to fully enter it starting right away. And a lot of it is a lot of this, it's called a fascicle, which means a religious essay, I think, basically. Anyway, a lot of it is about exactly how to do it. There's a lot of instructions about putting up signs and names and how people should describe themselves. He says that, you know, if you were an abbot of another temple, you should describe yourself as the Western Hall, from the Western Hall. And he points out that if it's a really tiny temple and you describe yourself that way, people are going to laugh at you. So you should call yourself, I don't know, senior or veteran or anything, but don't call yourself Western Hall, which means abbot. I guess the abbot had quarters on the western side of the temple, I presume. He starts out by referring to his teacher, and he describes the 90-day summer retreat, which is the very crown and countenance of Buddha after Buddha and ancestor after ancestor, all of whom have continually experienced it, meaning the ango, intimately in skin, flesh, bones, and marrow. Taking up the eye and the head crown of the Buddhas and ancestors, we make them into the days and months of 90 days of summer. One summer retreat is therefore something equivalent to Buddha after Buddha and ancestor after ancestor. The summer retreat from beginning to end is what an ancestor is. Beyond this, there is not a single additional inch of ground, nor is there a great earth. In other words, this is a big deal. but also in entering wholeheartedly into this practice period, you are ancestors. We are ancestors. We are Buddhas. This is taking time each year to set aside everything non-essential, because being a lay practice, work and family are pretty essential most of the time. Dogs. I guess she went upstairs, but at any rate, dogs, cats, you name them. But at any rate, anything non-essential, and wholeheartedly entering into this retreat practice, sitting, meditating every day, maybe twice a day, studying. And he says, you're already, you people that are doing this are already settled in practice, say. So he says, when the summer retreat began, it resembled your giving rise to your spiritual question. You're giving rise to your spiritual question. What is it? So he says, when the summer retreat began, it resembled your giving rise to your spiritual question. You're giving rise to your spiritual question. What is it? What is this? This is it, which is just another question. Okay, so when it begins, you have this question. I'd say, for me at any rate, there's a longing. There's a longing to sit. There's a longing to be quiet. There's a longing to give over. I have a longing to give over. I also have resistance to it, but I have this longing, and I could say a thirst for it. And I kind of forget, and then I enter into it, and then it feels really great. So when the summer retreat began, it resembled your giving rise to your spiritual question. And when it came to an end, it resembled your having torn asunder the nets and cages of your delusions. Torn asunder the nets and cages of your delusions. Maybe you feel this is I talking. Maybe you feel that you really did, you don't have that spiritual question anymore, that some longing has been satisfied. But there is a difference, you know, after you've sat a lot for a period of time, that it's not, that question may still be there, but it isn't grabbing you. There's a freedom, there's a lightness. And a lot of that is having, I think, torn asunder is kind of an unfortunate phrase, I think, but at any rate, having let down your guard and feeling the breeze of freedom from those nets and chains of delusions. The question doesn't grab you so hard, and the delusions don't grab you so hard. And he goes on, this is a Dogen joke. Well, it was not a joke exactly, probably, but so even though this is how it was, so he was probably talking to like 30, 50 people maybe. Even though this is how it was these last 3 months, there are some of you who may well have personally experienced it as hindering you from beginning to end. Well, For 10,000 miles, there has not been an inch of grass. So come on, pay me back for 90 days bored. You wasted our time here. He didn't say that, but that's what he means. Come on, pay me back. It's just shocking. And of course, there are people, all of us, who experience it as a hindrance some of the time. And some people experience it as a hindrance, you know, zazen and making the effort to look into oneself and own one's hindrances and delusions and shadow and so on. You know, it's a pain in the ass. And for some people, it is not possible to come into the room because they have so much doubt or so little faith in themselves. And so they experience having a schedule to follow as a tremendous imposition. And I, you know, I've spent 4 years at our monastery, and there were two 90-day Amro each year. And there were certainly people there that had, they hated it, I think. They hated a lot of it. And when you hate it, you make it really hard on yourself. One of the teachers, Reb Anderson, once said, you know, the way to make the period of Zazen last forever and be really difficult is to try to get there at the very last second so that it's as short as possible. But that if you come into the Zendo, into the meditation hall, with that attitude that you want it to be over, as someone else said in a slightly different context, that way lies the hell realm. And it's really true. And I had been somebody with that kind of an attitude, not towards the whole thing. I loved it actually, but I kind of had this habit of getting there as late as I could without being late. And I thought, well, I'm gonna try this, and so I did, and it made a tremendous difference because I did not walk into the Zendo with the idea that I wanted it to be over. I walked into the Zendo with the mind of, now I'm going to sit zazen. Ah, something a completely different attitude, and it became easier, and I spent much less time cursing the timekeeper. Sometimes, you know, time is a funny thing. Sometimes the same 40-minute period can go like that. I can't snap my fingers anymore. But and another one will feel like it's going on for about 2 years, and you're sure that the timekeeper fell asleep, or they hate you, or and then I steal a glance at a clock, and turned out they virtually never fell asleep. It was just my head. He says to do a summer retreat is to see Buddhas and ancestors, as well as to meet them. For a summer retreat has, for ever so long, created Buddhas and ancestors. We chant something at the very beginning of the practice period that's like Dogen's vow of practice, and he quotes a Chinese master who says that Buddhas and ancestors of old were as we shall be Buddhas and ancestors. And because we so often think, oh yeah, that's what they could do that. They were giants of the earth. They were in a monastery, and they were this, that, and the other thing. I'm sure that they spent time in tears on their cushions. I'm sure that their knees hurt. I'm sure that they had fantasies of killing their parents or their significant other or whatever. I did look at the dog. She got out of the car the other night, and I couldn't find her leash when I left my friend's house, and so she got out and started running around, and the car door slammed on my fingers. So yes, I did have a moment. At any rate, they, these ancestors, you know, they were jealous of somebody, or they were lusting after somebody, and they knew they were wrong and couldn't admit it. I'll stop. I could go on and on. And being intimate with this sort of thing, as we all are. If we can open to this, to realize that we're not so different from these role models, these Buddhas and ancestors, we're not so different. And we kind of don't get to just separate ourselves from them so much that we don't need to make the effort that they made, because I'm never going to be. So summer retreat for ever so long has created Buddhas and ancestors. So summer retreat for ever so long has created Buddhas and ancestors. This setting aside time to dedicate ourselves to practice is what creates Buddhas and ancestors. And what our job, if you will, is to give ourselves that time, to take ourselves seriously enough to set that time aside, to work with our work situation and our family situation and our pet situation or whatever in our life to minimize everything but practice. Of course, everything is practice, including all those ties and obligations. But this 7 weeks is a time to focus on practice, on zazen, and on studying, and on being with sangha. And we usually have what we call the practice period buddy, and you choose somebody. And you're welcome to do this. Anyway, you have a buddy, and so then you check in with each other once a week or whatever. Sometimes people go for walks or hang out together or talk on the phone or whatever. And there are people on the screen. On the, well, the one on the bottom right is in Port Townsend, Washington, right this second, and the one on the bottom left is in Los Angeles, and the one on the top left is in Portland.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Those people you can connect on Zoom or by phone. Huh. This is what creates mature practitioners. This is what creates the ability to loosen the grip on self. This is very long, but a lot of it is given up to these lists and descriptions of how to name people. Later he says, he refers to the greater and the lesser courses or vehicles, and that's our branch of Buddhism. This is part of what's called Mahayana Buddhism, and sometimes Maha means great. And we're the greater vehicle, and then
Nikaya?
No.
Theravada.
Yeah, well, Theravada will do Buddhism. There's another phrase that I'm trying to think, but at any rate, even though the ultimate, capital U, is to be found in both the greater and lesser courses, its branching, leafing out, flowering, and fruiting emerge from the 90-day retreat. And I think there's a lot of truth to that, that when we decide to really to devote ourselves to sitting down and getting quiet and paying attention, there is a flowering and fruiting. There is a letting go. There is an ease that arises from it. I'm sitting still even when you don't happen to feel like it right at the moment. This is a chart. And then those recitations. Okay, so the supervisor and trainees, the Tonto are probably. Balmy breezes fan over the fields and the emperor of heat rules everywhere. This is a time when obedience to the Lord of the law, we take not a step from the temple. These are the days for protecting the lives of Buddha's disciples. We have assembled the whole community in all humility and respectfully visit your sacred shrine. We recite the names of the great Buddhas of myriad virtues and offer their merit therefrom to you, the guardian deity of all the monastic halls. We pray for your divine protection and so on. And then they recite the names of Buddha. We offer the merits of this recitation to the guardians of the field, the dragons and celestial hosts. We like good stuff. you could translate it into more contemporary language. But why? There's a chief junior too. I don't know what a chief is. Is that the head monk or something? I'm not sure. Anyway, I'm trying to. I skimmed through this because I figured that we're not going to do this. Going on another essay about the kitchen, not the one that people usually study, but a different one says that the head of the kitchen should not forget to pray to the guardian of the oven. The training ground of a summer retreat is the realm of the mind seal, which is the teaching of the Buddha, the Dharma of the Buddha. The mind seal of the Buddhas and ancestors, and is the dwelling place of all Buddhas. Which is, I guess, what I just said before about the Buddhas and ancestors being here. They are in us, they are us, we are they. They're also there available to me. And we do stand on their shoulders, and it's useful to remember that, and also to remember that they weren't different from us. They weren't superhuman. You should simply understand the 90-day summer retreat as the Buddhas and ancestors have done, and rely upon it and preserve it. When I went to China, I directly received the genuine transmission from within the assembly of an ancestor of the Buddha, his teacher, Ru Jing, he's referring to. I received the genuine transmission from within the assembly of an ancestor of the Buddha, and I am doing the genuine transmission in Japan. He also says, keep in mind that male and female lay trainees can also do the retreat. So again, we don't get to say, oh well, those were those Japanese monastics who were, did nothing but live in the temple. Took out the paperclip.
You come all the way around.
He said the same thing again at the end. Yeah. Anyway, I just wanted to give us a taste of how he sees it and to encourage all of us to find a way to really enter this practice period, however that may be. There is a difference between what we do and going to a monastic place of practice for 90 days and not leaving that period, that place at all. And what we do is valuable, and you can feel it as anybody, but we have sometimes a senior student who helps lead the practice period, and they sit all the periods of Zazen that we offer, and then they find out in their own flesh and bones and marrow and skin that it does make a difference. And any of us can do this, most of it at any rate. So I encourage you to take up this practice for 7 weeks starting on October 1st and take the class. We're going to study Dogen this practice period, and I think we'll use the Bendo Wa as the text. However, we have a video of a conference about Dogen where really interesting people spoke about him. And we have a movie of his, a biography, somewhat embellished, somewhat fictionalized. And we're going to work with some of his poetry. And I think the lectures will all be from the Bendo Wa. And the class will have this more fun stuff. So I'm looking forward to it. We just have to figure out how to incorporate these things, because the movie is, what, 2 hours long, something like that. Mm-hmm. It's longer than a class we usually have, and the symposium was, I don't know, was it about a half a day?
It was probably close to that.
Yeah. Anyway, we'll see. So do you have any questions or comments? Does this resonate, or is this feel like, what does this have to do with me? I have to teach 10 classes a day. I'm speaking for Lisa, the one in Los Angeles. Yes?
I mean, that does bring up the point, how did it change from being summer to fall?
Well, it started out that it happened in Buddhist time during the monsoon season, which is the summer in India. And so that was a time when it was hard to be out wandering about. And also, according to the introduction somewhere, I don't know, I've been reading so much it all sort of pushes in together, but that people criticized the monks for being out and about when it was rainy because there were lots of little insects and things in the ground that you could easily step on and stuff. You're more likely to kill things. So it was better to stay put. So that reason too. And so I guess that's where it came from, because I don't know that Japan has a season that's particularly rainy like that, like a monsoon season, but they may, I don't know. Because it snows in the winter there, so they have precipitation. At any rate, that's where it comes from, and I guess that's where it started. And now, as I say, you know, Tassajara has two practice periods, so that's about 6 months there, and a little over because there's a break in between, and then there's the end of the spring practice period. There's a month of and then there's a fall work period, and then it goes into the practice period again. And I think that Eheiji has more. I'm pretty sure they have more than one practice period now, but I don't know. Anyway, that's where it started.
Well, I guess how is it that we started doing it in the
fall? Because I think I feel like the fall is a time of sort of things slowing down a little bit and quieting, and of the days getting shorter and there being more dark. Berkeley does two. They do one regular one that's 6 or 7 weeks long that they do in the spring. And then they do another one in the fall, which they call Aspects of Practice. And it's led by senior students rather than the abbot. And it's, 3 weeks long or something. So, but that's where the fall came from. And I know for you that the fall is a period of quickening. Anyway, I mean, we could talk about it, but it just seems like going into the summer is not a great time to, because everybody starts to disappear. Mm. Anyway, that's the thinking behind it, to the extent I remember. I know that's what I always say about it, but I don't.
Whether
it's lost
true or
in
not.
The sands of time. Well, I mean, I'm pretty sure, but I don't know how much we talked about it or thought about it. I mean, it was, I don't know, not probably like 18 years ago or something like that. And there wasn't the senior group that I could really talk with about it, like there is now. You know, the practice committee is made up of people that are pretty senior, and then there are other people that are pretty senior that could be consulted or something. We do sometimes talk about it, things like that, but anyway. Because it's getting dark. Because Wendy Johnson gave a wonderful talk one time many years ago when she was still the head of the garden at Green Gulch. She talked about the fallow time, you know, when the seeds are in the earth and they're not starting to sprout yet. They're just quiet and gathering energy. So something like that. Yes, Kate.
Thanks. Yeah, I was thinking that I always felt a kind of dissonance between, I mean, our practice, you know, we do the practice period in the fall and the natural world quiets. But I know when I was working full time, I always felt that kind of like, well, yeah, it'd be great if I could quiet, you know. But sitting more helped me quiet, even in the midst of all the busyness. I had to really struggle with how to do that and when to do it in that kind of a busy schedule that I was living. And there were a lot of hiccups and backward steps and resistance and many things. And what I find is that's not just a result of my schedule, because I can feel all those things with a less stressed schedule too. It's interesting. The other thought that I had was that when you were talking about we are the ancestors, we are like the ancestors, they're not so different than us. And that practice period during the height of the pandemic, when we were all on Zoom, and I happened to be Shuso that period, which I agreed to, not really knowing what I was getting myself into, truthfully.
That's it. Helps lead the practice period. Yes.
So, and it's a good thing I didn't, and I'm glad that I did. But I had a very profound experience of feeling the presence of our lineage that I had never had before. And I don't know that I could have had that experience without the focused intention and sitting that was required of me that period. And I'm grateful for that. And it's interesting, it wasn't like any kind of, oh, I'm enlightened now. it was just that experience, and it's a memory, and it's a part of me now, and that makes a difference. So I look forward to studying Dogen. I feel resistant to sitting more than I already sit, and I think that's all.
Anybody else?
Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Illusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Illusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to end them.